Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 7th. The first order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative New moves approval of the minutes dated March 1st. Is there any corrections, additions, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Makewood.
On behalf of the freshman, I'd like to welcome Representative New to the committee. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you're like a 2 weeks late, Representative Makewood. That's fine.
My apologies.
That's all right. All right, so first up is House File 623, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson moves that House File 623 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Anderson, do you have any amendments to your bill?
No, I do not.
All right, Representative Anderson, to your bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members. This bill is a direct appropriation to the Eagles Healing Nest. It's a veterans home in Sauk Center, Minnesota. And some background here, the Nest was awarded the same dollar amount in the bonding bill 2 or 3 years ago to repair the roofs on their campus. And what this place is, it's a former state-run school for girls and boys dating back to the early 1900s, and it was closed by the state in the 1990s. And it's a beautiful campus that has 24 buildings. A lot of them are dormitory-style, two- or three-story buildings, but they're old and they're badly in need of repair. Some of them have flat roofs, and you know what flat roofs do around here. There's water damage and very much in need for roof repairs and such. We got the money in the bonding bill, like I say, 2 or 3 years ago, but the Eagle's Nest is a 501c3, and because of state regulations, the money had to go through a fiscal agent. And the city of Sauk Center agreed to be the fiscal agent to handle the money, bonding money coming from the state. But because of some legal requirements, such as putting a 65-year lien on the roof, or which later got changed to a 20-year lien, if any change took place in the Nest in the ensuing 20 years, the city of Sauk Center would have been liable to repay the entire amount of $300,000. They, I think rightfully so, chose not to take on that liability. So the money never did get sent out to the Eagles Healing Nest. And so that's the reason for this bill today. We learned that a direct appropriation was far easier than trying to go through bonding because of the requirements associated with 501c3. So, Mr. Chair, that's the bill in a nutshell. It's a wonderful facility. Speaker Doubt was out there over the weekend at a program, and there are 70 veterans living there, veterans helping veterans heal, and it's an outside-the-box way they're doing it, but it's yielding very, very good results in that area.
Representative Anderson, do you have any testifiers for you today?
I don't, because it's not really a veterans issue, so I don't have any, sir.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions or comments. Members of the committee, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, you know, in this world of the Internet, you can find anything. So maybe you can explain this to me. Back in February, your guest column to the, what was it, I'm not even sure newspaper it was, but your quote here is, but with the donations that came in last weekend at the fundraiser sponsored by KASM Radio and Melrose Beacon, here you put it in the beacon, it put the project over the top. There should be enough money to finish all the buildings at the Nest. What does that mean? That you raised all the money and you don't really need the $300,000, or You want to just explain that a little deeper?
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, there were donations that helped pay for some of the roof projects, and I left the language the way it was. It could be changed. I don't know how much would actually be needed now to finish some of the maintenance projects there. It's kind of a jobs bill as well, and helping them with their programs. But, yeah, you're correct. A lot of donations came in to help pay for roof repair. So this would not all go to that, but other maintenance issues with the 24 buildings on campus. And I talked to the folks there, and their service programs like suicide prevention type things. But so that's, I guess it would be an appropriation that would be used for maintenance and other programs that they would see fit to use them for.
Representative Mahoney, follow up.
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with helping veterans, but not sure this is quite the right committee, but chairman gets to decide what's the right particular way to spend money. And, this looks more like a state government finance bill or a health and human services bill, the way you just explained it. So I'll leave it at that. $300,000 for suicide prevention or job training or whatever it is with veterans, I think is a good idea. Just don't know that this is the appropriate committee.
Thank you for your comments. You can also follow up offline with Chair Garofalo, too. I'm sure he'd probably be able to get a little more detail for you. Any further member questions? With that, Representative Anderson, you renew your motion to have this laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Thank you.
Next up, members, Representative Rarick, House File 631. Welcome to the committee, Representative Rarick. And did you have an amendment? Let's move your bill here, and then we'll move your amendment. Representative Rarick, to your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment just gets us into the language that we wish to have.
All right. Right now, let's go ahead and move the bill. Representative Rarick moves House File 631 to be laid over for possible inclusion, and then also to your amendment to bring it into the shape that you intend. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Rarick, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 631 is a bill that would build new high school programs in the skilled trades so high schools can work with employers to offer internship programs. Minnesota employers are experiencing a workforce shortage, especially in skilled trades. Manufacturers and related industries cannot find enough workers. It's clear that young people aren't finding their way to this skilled work. We used to do a really good job preparing high school kids for skilled work. We used to have shop classes and woodworking classes in schools. Students could go to VOTEC programs at the local community colleges after graduation or go to registered apprenticeship programs. I took many of these shop classes in high school and followed up with an electrical apprenticeship program. But these high school programs are now few and far between, yet the jobs remain. Employers have thousands of jobs to fill, jobs that pay good wages and have good benefits, but they don't have young people coming in to fill those needs. Employers have been asking what they can do to help prepare students. They want to offer internships and jobs to kids as early as high school. Employers and school districts have been trying to find ways to get these programs going, and some have had really good success with this. But we need to make the process easier so we can get more employers engaged in offering these internship programs. What this bill really solves is how to get kids under 18 into these programs. Federal law provides a student learner pathway for kids under 18 to be in work-based learning. Minnesota does not have a student learner pathway, so this bill defines what a student learner is and creates a framework for schools to build programs. House File 631 places oversight for the program with the Minnesota Department of Labor because they are the agency tasked with overseeing work, OSHA and child safety laws. This bill does not alter any child safety laws. What this bill does is creates a better way for the Department of Labor to review programs for adherence to child safety standards and provide program approvals. Students can work on the job site, but certain activities may be limited if they are considered hazardous. Students on the job site must be under the direct and close supervision of a qualified and experienced person. Our bill also provides that students are paid wages in accordance with Minnesota wage laws. It is our expectation that employers will pay at least minimum wage and no state funding will be used to supplement those wages. We also direct DLI to work with industry to define high-growth, high-demand occupations eligible for the program and define the skill sets that are needed. DLI can provide technical assistance to local partnerships, and we want DLI to work with the partnerships and identify paths to registered apprenticeship and post-secondary programs. Districts can grant academic credit for the program, and if an apprenticeship program wants to count some of the training hours from these programs toward their apprenticeship hours, they may. Section 2 contains a grant appropriation, funds for the first year or for the development of the program, and then after that, these grants are for the districts. The amendment adds labor unions to the list of those who can participate to make sure that they were not left out. And with that, I would ask that our testifiers come forward for their part.
Welcome, McMinnie. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Amy Wallstein. I'm Government Relations for the Minnesota Precision Manufacturers Association. And we have, I believe in your materials, a handout from the MPMA outlining some of the reasons why we're in support of this bill, along with many of the other manufacturing groups and Medical Alley Association. And so where this bill came from was manufacturing community has a very strong is very strong in Minnesota. We have 14% of the state's GDP and 9% of the state's workforce. But the skilled manufacturing workforce is aging, and manufacturers are just not seeing young people coming into the industry. Manufacturers are ready, willing, and able to offer internship and apprenticeship opportunities for students to help train that next generation of workers, but they do need a better framework in order to help them provide that work-based training for students. So we see House File 631 is helping build that framework for work-based training at the high school level. In the bill, we're addressing barriers faced by schools and employers who have tried to bring high school students into the workplace but get stuck with the barrier between 16, 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds. So we took a look at best practices from other states like Wisconsin, Colorado, South Carolina, where they have built very robust youth apprenticeship programs. And we tried to take some of the best practices from those states and integrate it into our Minnesota work-based learning framework. So the overall goal is to make sure that young people who are interested in manufacturing, skilled trades, engineering, have the opportunity to learn on the job site while they are in high school.
Ms. Walskin, was there any testimony against this or any no votes in the Education Finance Committee?
Chair Garofalo, the comments that were made in House Education Finance Committee, Representative Dabney, I believe it was, raised the question of why labor unions weren't part of the local partnerships. And so we took that feedback from House Education and incorporated it into the amendment that's before you today.
Was there any dissent? Did anyone vote against it?
No.
Representative Eric, do you have any other testifiers?
No, we don't.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Ms. Fuji, did you wish to testify? No? Okay, I'm sorry. She tried. Seeing that, we'll close public comment, move to member questions and comments. Representative Baker and then Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Burke. This is a great bill. I was looking through this earlier. Is there any components of this bill that tries to split it up a little bit more equal, 50-50 rural, metro? Is there anything like that that kind of applies to just how we look at this from the commissioner's standpoint? It's a great bill, but I'm just curious about that kind of component.
Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, that it is open to all high schools. There's nothing that's going to try to, whichever programs are wanting to get into it and get involved. Right now, it will probably be focused in areas that have manufacturing in the region because Current law would lean it that way. But this has the potential to open up to many other areas in the future.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've had a couple of meetings on this, and it's my own fault. I didn't get back to the people who are working on it. But I've got a series of questions, so I'll start with on page 1, line 9. It's open to learners 16 and older. I know of no manufacturer, no construction firm, no business that has liability insurance that allows a 16-year-old onto a shop floor or on a job site. So how do you plan on getting jobs for these kids outside of school?
Ms. Walstein?
Chair Garofalo, Representative Mahoney. So what we did when we took the definition of student learner and we looked at how that's set up in other states and we looked at how that's set up at the federal level, and we also sat down with insurance providers to ask them what their barriers were in providing insurance to students under 18. And so the feedback that we got from the insurers that we spoke with was that if they're in a program that is approved by the Department of Labor that meets those federal and state requirements, that's then something that would potentially be insurable. I don't want to say yes or no for any particular insurer, but that that with the program being housed at the Department of Labor, there was more comfort among insurers to provide that liability insurance.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, that kind of gets me to my next question. I'm not entirely sure. I don't remember exactly where I saw it on here. But who's going to be inspecting these places? Because I think, where is it, program approval, or where you can terminate the agreement with any manufacturer. Who's going to be doing the inspection to make sure that a 16-year-old is safe? Because this is the result, I'm pretty sure, of a construction injury that happened in a pretty safe OSHA environment, and it was a 30-year-old that did it, not a 16-year-old. Not to say I was smarter than a 16-year-old at the time, but how are you going to inspect that? How are you going to assure us that that 16-year-old has actually got the supervision? Because in an apprenticeship program, it's now on a job construction site, I think it's immediate and direct with a limit to how many apprentices can work underneath a journey person. And none of that is in here. It's kind of an open book as to who's doing the teaching and how much supervision they need. I mean, I like the idea. I get it. But this has got to have a little bit more connection to some of our sections of law that cover apprenticeship programs. So that's what I'm asking. Who's going to do all this checking? And are we paying Dolly? Are we going to hire another person with Dolly to check this?
No, Ms. Walstein?
Chair Garofalo. A lot of questions. So the program oversight is with the Department of Labor. And so on the front end, the Department of Labor will be reviewing programs for adherence with child safety and other appropriate state standards for safe work. And we do have language in here also that if the Department of Labor finds that there isn't a safe environment for kids, that they are able to terminate the program. So I think a lot of the fine details on that will be worked out over at Department of Labor, and I don't want to speak for them in terms of what they're going to how they're going to set all of the details of the program, but we have thought through how oversight would ensure children's safety, and we have that housed with Department of Labor.
So Representative Rarick and Ms. Wallstein, my advice would be we're laying this bill over today, so we're not taking action on it, but as we go forward and whether it's included in a later bill or not, please be sure to include Representative Mahoney in those conversations. He has forgotten more about these types of programs than all of us know combined. So, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, to Ms. Wallstein's credit, she asked me two or three times, and I did not get to it, so it's my fault. I will accept that.
And the minutes will note that Representative Mahoney admitted fault on March 7th at 3:21 p.m.
And Mr. Chair, we should catch up because I think the department needs to step up and give us a clearer outline of where they're going to go with this and how they're going to get there. Because I think this could cost – somebody needs to pay for that FTE to check and make sure kids are safe and they're learning something.
Yeah, so just please make sure that you include Representative Mahoney with these questions. But do you want to elaborate before I go to Representative Haley? Ms. Wallstein.
Chair Grapple, Representative Mahoney. We do have a small appropriation in the bill for Department of Labor. I think that if they were to provide a fiscal note, it may be a little higher than that. But Deputy Commissioner Luman was not able to be here. She was in the Education Finance Committee hearing last week, and she did provide some testimony at that time. So she's on the record as having made some comments and having reviewed the bill pretty thoroughly.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. And I'm sorry I was at another committee, but I wanted to speak in support and as a co-author with Representative Rarick. And maybe my comments can address some of the concerns. I was involved in my community trying to bridge education and industry and working on a project for about 3 years that we called Red Wing Works. And we ran into this hurdle on trying to help students get manufacturing experience and on-the-job training. So the things that we ran into would be corrected from this bill. So I just wanted to comment as somebody who's been trying to do that work and expose kids to these types of careers. The manufacturing industry in southeastern Minnesota has the most manufacturers per capita than anywhere else in the country. Fascinating statistic. And, of course, you've heard about the need to fill these jobs. Another thing to maybe point out is since CTE has gone away in a lot of our public high schools, we've lost the shop classes. So we've lost even the welding or the building. And as you all know, we don't have money in education to rebuild those shop classes. So this is an opportunity to get those kids out in industry where that exists. That's particularly true in districts that don't have the resources and in rural Minnesota. In other districts that maybe have fab labs, I know there's one in Apple Valley, they have, in fact, very advanced equipment. So in some cases, students may be working on 3D printers, advanced welding, and working on machines that are as complex as exist in industry. So students may be already exposed, you know, in some areas. So just kind of wanted to point that out. I see that as somewhat of an equity issue as well. So if we can provide this opportunity for all kids, regardless of rural or metro and their resources. So I want to speak in support of this and all the work that Representative Rarick has done, and I think it really is one of the critical pieces to bridge the CTE gap that we're trying to achieve in all of some of our other education reforms.
Representative McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Rarick, you told me you had a bill that I would like, and you're right. I just wanted to know about how many students or schools do you think could be supported with this initial pilot grant?
Ms. Wallstein?
Chair Garofalo, Representative McQuaid. Initially, we were looking at targeting it to 5 schools, and as we started to hear from school districts, they were saying we'd like the opportunity to participate in the program regardless of whether we would get some grant money. So we kind of removed some of those parameters around the grant funding. But and also to Representative Baker's questions, where we've seen a lot of interest in this is from metro school districts as well as a lot of greater Minnesota school districts. So I think that there's the need out there, and we've talked to a lot of the CTE folks. We've talked to a lot of the school folks, and they're ready for this.
Representative Rarick, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been working with a number of schools in my area that are trying to get back into programs such as this, and I just see this as a great opportunity to get kids experience. Maybe they'll determine that they don't like this type of career and they're going to go to something else, but if we can get them at the 16, 17-year-old age group, we can maybe solve some, college debt problems and get people filling jobs that are really, really needed. So thank you.
With that, Representative Rarick renews his motion to have House File 631 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Hamilton, come on down. And let's see here. We got... Representative Baker moves that House File 635 be recommended to pass. And I expect that this bill is going to need to go to capital investment, so we're going to make the motion to recommend it pass and refer to the Capital Investment Committee. Representative Hamilton, the A1 amendment is your amendment, is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
My understanding is this is technical in nature. Is there any discussion on getting the bill in the form the author would like? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Members, the A2 amendment, is there someone here from Housing Finance who can explain this? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Katie Topinka. I'm the Legislative Director at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. The A2 amendment is an amendment that doesn't have any cost, but in 2014 and 2015 bonding bills, Minnesota Housing was authorized to issue housing infrastructure bonds, and those are appropriation bonds we use to fund supportive housing, preservation of federally assisted housing, and community land trust for land acquisition. At the time that we issued the bonds, the debt service costs ended up being much lower than was originally anticipated because of the low interest rate environment and a number of other factors. And so because of that, we have debt service capacity remaining in the existing appropriation, but we don't have authorization to issue more bonds. And so the amendment would allow us to issue up to $20 million in additional housing infrastructure bonds using existing debt service that has already been appropriated by the state.
So to the testifier, this doesn't cost anything. We've already authorized it, and no one's against it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. I have not heard any opposition to it, and the debt service has already been authorized.
Representative Hamilton, is that in concurrence with your wishes as the author of the bill?
That it is, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion from members of the committee? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton, to your bill.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is the Lewis and Clark project. Many of you are familiar with this project. We're trying to get water to the city of Worthington. We've been working on this for a number of years. Basically, it was brought forward in three phases. We completed phase one that brought the water to the city of Laverne. Phase two brought us to the Lincoln and Pipestone water hookup. And now phase three would take it into the city of Worthington. What this bill does, we understand that we're looking for additional dollars in another bill through the bonding committee to finish phase three. However, there are some existing funds left over from the completion of phase two. So we'd like to have the authority to take those additional funds to keep on with the construction process going towards the city of Worthington until the bonding bill would pass with the additional revenues to complete the project. So I do have a testifier, Mr. Chairman, and then I'll open it for question.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Hain. I'm the general manager of Worthington Public Utilities and also a director on the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System Board of Directors. The bill as proposed, as Representative Hamilton indicated, would just be authorization to utilize surplus funds that were already appropriated in 2015. We did receive a $19 million appropriation due to a very favorable bidding environment. We estimate that there will be approximately $8 million of that $19 million appropriation unspent. Our request in the bonding bill last year for phase three, and we are also in the governor's proposal and in the Senate's bonding bill for $11.5 million. Should we get access to that $8 million in appropriation bonds that have already been appropriated, then that would correspondingly reduce our request in this year's bonding from $11.5 million down to $3.5 million. We are ready. The $19 million that we did receive permitted construction to Lincoln Pipestone's connection near Adrian, but also we were allowed to spend those funds to get Adrian to Worthington shovel-ready, meaning final engineering and land acquisition. All of those activities have been completed, and we're actually ready to go out and advertise for bids within the next month, and theoretically, should we get access to that approximately $8 million in surplus, we would award that construction contract prior to the end of this session.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton, do you have any other invited testifiers?
None that I know of.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion. Move to member questions and comments. Questions from members of the committee? Representative McGinnis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hamilton, I got a chance to go to your construction site. Fascinating, watching somebody go through a pipe this big round, laying on their back, checking it out. It was fascinating. What was even more interesting to me was there were absolutely no women working in construction. If I go again and we appropriate this money, would I see women working on the site? I suspect these are quite good-paying jobs.
Representative Hamilton, why didn't you hire any women for this project?
Mr. Chairman, if it was up to me, they'd all be women. I'd hire all of them. I guess in all seriousness, if there's someone from the project that would like to comment on that, of course I don't have any authority on the hiring process, but if there's somebody else that would like to comment on that.
I do know that from previous testimony we had in this committee that the construction trade said that 91% of the workforce right now is male, but they're always, especially in this environment, they're always looking to expand the pool of quality candidates. I know that's something that they're making a particular effort at getting into, not just the iron workers, the pipe fitters, the construction trades. They want to expand the number of women working in that because it's not only a matter of qualifications, but it's a matter of competitiveness. A lot of these sectors are just short workers, and so it makes no sense to have qualified individuals not participating.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, and Representative Guinness brings up a good point. And I think the individuals working on these pipelines and others, I mean, these are noble, honorable professions. And I would say that collectively we all need to do a good job of promoting the fact that these are honorable professions and get to not only more women involved, but more people in general applying for these positions, because a lot of times we're short on the labor side of things.
Representative Hamilton, so it is a Hamilton bill, so I have to ask this. On page 3, line 9, I see dots that are listed for the appropriation. Can you give this committee some assurances of what that number will not be more than? Or,
right?
Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, I think we took care of that with the amendment. Did we not?
Okay. Just want to make sure, like, you really did delete it. Sorry. Seeing no additional discussion, Representative Baker renews his motion to have House File 635 as amended, recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hanson.
Thank you. Members of the committee.
Representative Baker, you're next. Is Representative Crescia here? Okay. That's fine. Usually we have... Representative Baker moves that House File 805 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Baker. Do you have any amendments to your bill, Representative Baker?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a what I consider kind of a small business, common sense kind of a bill when, as a homeowner, you need a new water softener. Typically right now we've got to call in a licensed plumber to come in and make a hookup to the hard plumbing system. And also, in a small business like I run in a restaurant, if my dishwasher lease, which I run through a large company, comes out on a Friday night, they can actually work on my machine, but if I have to replace anything on it or replace the machine quick, I've actually got to call a plumber right now to have that replaced.
if these if the pipe diameter is at any size. What this bill does today, members, is it brought some people together so we don't have to call licensed plumber in and to help us save a few dollars to have these what I would call the pretty basic plumbing operations done. And again, what I've appreciated about this bill, this has been tried to come through these committees before, but we also have gotten some of the folks to come together on this to find some good common ground here. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifier, and I would appreciate that time. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to your testimony. And Representative Baker, hot off the presses, we just got a fiscal note. Oh. So we literally just got a fiscal note, so Representative Baker is going to modify his motion to have this bill laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yep. I'm Jeffrey Hill, Chairman Garofalo, members of the committee. Thanks for allowing me to speak. I own Robert B. Hill Company, a water conditioning manufacturer and dealer in St. Louis Park. I'm also a board member of the Minnesota Water Quality Association. Minnesota exports over $700 million of high-technology water products, employing 16,000 people. Pentair, Dow Membranes, General Electric, Ecolab, EcoWater have significant operations in Minnesota. But in Minnesota, it's the water conditioning contractors that bring this technology to our homes, our institutions, and our businesses. You may have a water softener or a filter in your home, and you may know of this need in local businesses that you frequent. But not only do you want soft water, but you and your family may need protection from nitrates, volatile organic compounds, arsenic, or radium. And we have this expertise, and we specialize in this technology. Now, the Department of Labor and Industry licenses our people as water conditioning journeymen or as water conditioning masters. And our industry has a lot of strong training programs. But we need a DLI registry for our employees and training, and House File 805 deals with this. And we've been hampered in our ability to make piping connections, as Representative Baker said, in small commercial settings, and House 805 addresses this. Now, plumbers are our partners in every setting, so I'm happy that we've been able to work with the pipe trades and also the mechanical contractors to develop this legislation. Now, I've learned that legislating is arduous, but the 3 years of work that we've just completed with the Department of Labor and Industry and our partners has served to build strong bonds and shared knowledge that has benefited us and we think will benefit consumers.
If I could just interrupt for one quick second. What was your name, sir?
Jeffrey Hill.
Okay. Mr. Hill, is it correct that this bill is what I would call a peace in the valley bill?
It is.
And am I correct in saying that there's no opposition to it?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I only have two paragraphs.
Please, give your testimony.
In fact, I want to thank Representative Baker and the 8 House co-authors. That's what I have remaining. And the other representatives that have helped us in bring this bill this far. And finally, I'd just like to say that plumbing is public health, and the passage of this bill reminds us of our responsibility. Minnesota Water Quality Association pledges continuing work to protect public health and consumer value. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'll take any questions if you have them.
Thank you. Well, we'll cycle through all the public testimony, and then we'll come back to questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next on the list is Christy LaForest, and then Gary Thaden. Mr. Thaden, are you here? You're on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, Chris DeLaForest, representing the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. The pipe trades are one of the stakeholder groups that participated in the compromise bill you see before you and would urge the committee's support. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Thaden?
My name is Gary Thaden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association. We do plumbing, heating, and cooling throughout the state of Minnesota, and we support this bill.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions. Questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Baker, any closing comments?
It's a great bill. Members, appreciate your support.
And I do want to thank the department for getting us the fiscal note so that it would have been embarrassing to send it to the General Register and then send it back. So we are going to lay it over to finance bill. So with that, Representative Baker renews his motion to have House File 805 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Baker, and thank you to the testifiers. Let's see. Why don't we take, is it Representative Kreischer or Eklund here? Eklund, Representative Eklund, let me take your bill up. Representative Sundin moves that House File 1307 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. And Representative Sundin, my understanding is that there is, or excuse me, Representative Eklund, that there is a technical oral amendment that needs to be made to the bill. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. 1.7, we would like to strike the word general fund and insert workforce development fund.
Okay.
And on 1.9, we'd like to strike organization and put in office.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. So just to be clear, did staff get that, the two changes? Okay. So with that, Representative Metza will move that amendment to make the changes on 1.7 and 1.9. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Eklund, do you have any other amendments?
No, Mr. Chair.
To your bill. And Representative Eklund, is this your first time before the committee?
No, it's my second time. I brought cookies last
That's
time.
That's right. Okay. We, I don't know. Maybe we need an unofficial rule that Iron Rangers got to pay twice, right? I don't know. Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this bill provides a one-time appropriation to the Boys Fort Band's Tribal Employment Office. TARO is a mechanism that some tribes use to fund workforce training on the reservation, and with that I have Reed LeBeau to help me explain a little bit more about the TARO in depth.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reed LeBeau on behalf of the Boys Fort Band. TARO is a federal creation. Indian tribes generally don't have taxing authority as the state understands taxing authority on income property tax. And what TARO allows is when there's a, in many cases, a federal highway program or a project that would go through the reservation or near the reservation, there's a TARO fee, otherwise just known as a tax, that's assessed on that work that then goes into the TARO pot and that's used for workforce training purposes. The complication that we have with federal law is that the federal law says that it's for projects that are on or near the reservation, and Congress decided when they passed the law not to define what near meant. So we have, you're shocked, I'm sure. What this bill would do is just provide a one-time appropriation so that we could expand the programs. Right now, unemployment on the Boys Fort reservation is roughly 20%. And this is a unique opportunity to partner with the band to have very specific targeted workforce training on the reservation, have near immediate impact. We'd have the ability to expand our workforce training opportunities, and we think that we could almost immediately get to a good chunk of that 20%.
Representative Eklund, do you have any other invited testifiers?
All right, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions and comments. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Metza. And again, welcome back, Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more than a cameo this time, so I'll be around a little more here as we're moving. And thank you, Representative Eklund, for bringing forward this bill. I know many members of the tribe live in my district and work in my communities, and I think this is a great program, and in respect of time for the committee, I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from members? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It, from the testimony, it sounds like you have already decided what kind of training you're going to do. Could you share that with the committee?
Mr. LeBeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney. One of the things that we're looking at and excited to be able to offer is electronic health records and billing. That's a huge need that we have on the reservation right now, and we simply don't have the employee pool to be able to do that work.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Thiessen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So what is the $250,000?
Use the mic, Representative Thiessen.
What do you spend the $250,000 on? Is that to hire the trainers?
Mr. LeBeau.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, it's specifically for the training, the actual training of the individuals.
Representative Thiessen.
And how did you come up with $250,000?
Mr. LeBeau.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, looking at the budget and trying to make an assessment of the different types of training that we are trying to offer.
Representative Deason? Any additional comments or questions from members of the committee? Representative Eklund, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill is a partnership with BAND I represent in District 3A and allows us to allocate money for targeted relief of our state citizens, and I appreciate the time for your committee.
With that, Representative Sundin renews his motion to have House File 1307 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Crescia. Representative West moves that House File 1235 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Crescia, to your bill, do you have any amendments to the bill?
I do not.
Okay. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm here today to present House File 1235, the Rural Jobs Act. This bill incentivizes private investment of $100 million in businesses located in rural Minnesota who employ less than 250 people and has no more than $15 million in net income for the preceding tax year. And with that, I'd like to hand this off to my testifier, Mr. Dressler.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Ryan Dressler with Advantage Capital. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'll just take a few minutes to talk about this bill, and I want to start by just telling you a little bit about Advantage Capital. So we are a small business investor, and we invest in everywhere in the country except for the coast, for the most part. And what makes us unique is that for the last 25 years, we have partnered with different states, 28 now, and also the federal government to bring capital to underserved areas. And when we say underserved, that's not only rural areas or urban areas that have high poverty rates. It could also be underserved industries like manufacturing. And so over that 25 years, we've invested in close to 700 unique small businesses across the country. And one thing that's become really important to us is rural investing. And about a quarter of our portfolio has been in rural small businesses. And it's been something that has caught our eye as an area that's been well underserved across the country, and especially here in Minnesota. So I'm sure a lot of you have followed the stories about community banks and the loss of community banks and the struggle that small businesses have had trying to get capital to grow their businesses. There was recently an article in the Dallas Federal Reserve. It was a report that came out. And the stats that stuck with me were, one, today the amount of small business lending that's happening is still 15% below the levels before the recession. Meanwhile, overall business lending is 33% up. So there's a huge change in where the money is being invested. The other stat that was pretty alarming is that for loans of $1 million or less, that used to make up about 40% of the portfolio for small business lending, and now it's only about 20%. So a pretty significant change. And the reason that's hurting businesses in rural Minnesota is because, you know, for a business to work, they get capital. They use that capital to buy equipment to expand a plant. They hire people to work in those machines or to produce something or provide a service, and then they provide that product or service to the market and hope that that sells, and they can then make money and reinvest in their business and continue to grow. And when that capital piece is missing, and as the banks in the communities where these rural areas are continue to shrink, it's even more challenging for them to get access to that. So the Rural Jobs Act, which Representative Crescia started to introduce there, is about getting federally licensed investors who have a track record under the SBA or the USDA of raising capital, like Advantage Capital would be one of those many companies, to raise capital only in Minnesota and invest just in the greater Minnesota area. And what makes us different from other tax credit programs, even ones focused on rural, is that oftentimes a small business doesn't actually need an incentive themselves. They need capital that's flexible, and they need an investor who understands that relationship. And they may need $2 to $4 million to build a plant, to add, have the working capital to add employees, and to actually grow the business. So this program offers, it's a post-performance tax credit at the fund level to raise this $100 million and then invest it into rural businesses in greater Minnesota. And so that's something that makes it unique. Another thing that makes it unique is the tax credit is delayed for 2 years. Meanwhile, that $100 million needs to be invested in the first 2 years. So $100 million is raised and invested all by private investors, and then a total of $60 million of tax credits is redeemed over the last 4 years of the program. So that's years 3, 4, 5, and 6. And so that delay allows that money to be at work in these communities, growing businesses before any revenue or tax credits are claimed in those out years. The last thing I'd like to do, and then I'm happy to answer any questions, is just talk about an example of a business. So I can talk about a recent investment we made in the state of Utah. It's in a town called Gunnison, Utah, which is, call it 90 miles south of Salt Lake City, a town of about 5,500 people. And the company is called ACT Aerospace, and they produce high-end parts for helicopters and other vehicles, so everything from ball bearings to very complicated parts. And they were expanding to produce new parts for the Bell helicopter. And they needed capital that was more flexible than they could get from a bank in the area so that they could add about 15 employees immediately and then 15 the next year to produce those parts. So through a similar modeled program there, we were able to provide an investment to that company. They've added the 15 employees and plan to add another 15 next year. It's not making national news, 30 jobs, but for a town of 5,500, 30 jobs that have an average salary or wage of about $51,000 at the company is a really big deal. And so that's what this program is targeted to do. So with that, I'll leave it for comments.
Representative Kreisha, do you have any additional testifiers?
I do not, Madam Chair.
Okay. Would any members of the public like to testify? Seeing none, are there any questions from the members? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's your profit margin when you make these investments? What is your investor's profit margin?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the question is about profit margin for the actual fund manager. So the way this program is set up is only half of the fund is raised through tax credits, right? Those $60 million of tax credits is going to raise a portion of the capital. The rest of the money, 10% of it must come from the fund manager themselves, and the rest of the capital must be raised from another private source, and those investors are going to have a market rate of return that they're seeking. Okay, and that rate of return can range, but generally you see ranges or expectations between 8 and 15% depending on a fund of what a private investor would want to see out of a fund like that. So for an Advantage Capital or another fund that participates this, that has one of those qualifying licenses, they can't take fees in this program. And instead, their hope is that in making these investments, that at the end of this six-year period, that the businesses are able to pay back, and that there is still principal remaining in that fund after all of the other investors have paid back and all of the costs of investing in the businesses have been covered over that time period. So looking at our historical portfolio, our average return across our entire fund is between 4 and 4.5%. And we've got to say that very specifically. We are under the SEC as a registered investment advisor, so we talk about funds in aggregate. So that's about the range that we would hope to get. This tax credit, if you break down the 60% over those 6 years, is about 10% per year. And that's really there to offset the difference between a 15% return, which the market would expect, and then the 4 to 5% return that is probably likely given it's invested in rural Minnesota.
Representative Thiessen.
You can go to Mahoney. Yes.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kreisha, this is the Investment in Rural Jobs Tax Credit. So who are you excluding from this tax credit?
Madam Chair.
Representative Kreisha.
And I'm going to turn to nonpartisan House research for that because I don't know the best way to answer that. And maybe my testifier has a better answer. I'll turn it over to Mr. Dressler.
Mr. Dressler.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Mahoney. The way that the rural is defined in the bill, which I think is the question, it's defined using the same definition that the USDA uses to determine rural eligibility. And the numbers, I believe, are towns, cities, or villages with less than 50,000 in population, and they also have to be outside of a metropolitan statistical area. So if there is a large metropolitan area, a smaller community that is adjacent to it wouldn't qualify outright. So if you look at greater Minnesota or any state, it's Swiss cheese, and there's a little bit of expansion around the metropolitan areas, but then any other area under 50,000 would qualify.
No, Madam Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So I'm going to guess that the Twin Cities, the 11-county Twin City area, is included in the exemption. probably Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester. Would that be a good guess, Representative Crecia, or?
Representative Crecia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, yes, going through lines 2.16 to 2.22, that would be accurate.
And just so you know, Madam Chair, if I might, Representative Crecia, you're carrying a bill of a really, really good friend of mine, and I'm not a huge fan of market tax credits. I've signed on to a number of bills. There used to be a legislator here, Winchester, that schooled me in market credits. But I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go there on that particular piece. By census tract, and I'll send this around, but look at both sheets. There's poverty across our state. And in many ways, you went to Greater Minnesota, and there's lots of poverty in Greater Minnesota or areas that this would affect. But there's just as many people. There's not as much land mass in urban Minnesota in the Twin Cities. I'm just going to use the Twin Cities because that's where I represent. My problem, and I'll pass this along to let people know, but I like it back because color copies are hard to get in this particular building. So why the number of people in poverty in urban Minnesota is no different statistically than the number of people in poverty in Greater Minnesota, or those areas that you didn't exclude. And what this bill does is it divides the state. Now, you know, Representative Albright's got a bill coming down the pike. It's got $100 million or better. It's got a lot of money for investors. The new market tax credits have worked across the state in multiple different places. And evenly divided. Why do you want to set up a two Minnesota kind of us against them mentality? That's what I have a problem with this. And the bad thing is that I, as an urban legislator, get accused of trying to do it all the time, and I have never tried to do that. So why do you want to try and create two Minnesotas? And I'm being kind, just so you know.
I understand.
Representative Crecia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mahoney, you're right on. And let me answer it this way. I'm not trying to set up two Minnesotas. If that's an unintended consequence or if that's a lens that's being viewed through, I understand that. I'm trying to address a problem that I see every day. I work with economic development firms. I work with small companies. I work with small communities. And we have a problem of people leaving. And it's a people problem. And there's lots of different ways on how we get there, but the fact of the matter is in rural Minnesota, as in other rural parts of the country, people are leaving for metropolitan areas. They're not always coming back to the homesteads. But we have this exodus that's happening one way. It's what we're dealing with. And now we're seeing with the silver tsunami, now we're seeing with the people leaving the workforce, whereas we used to be competing with rural Minnesota with the metropolitan area. We're now going to start to see the state of Minnesota competing with Iowa, South Dakota, and these regional competitions are going to come. I can't address all that. I come from rural Minnesota. I see this in my backyard every day. What I'm doing here is trying to address what I see and what I see in my communities. I'd be more than happy to support the metropolitan one as well. I'm not trying to divide. I'm trying to solve what I'm seeing every day and the way that our communities are responding to, frankly, smaller families, and just less people, and a very difficult time accessing capital. When you're in rural Minnesota, and this may be also the conditions that you would see in the metro area, but when you're in rural Minnesota and you have banks that are having a hard time getting you the capital and taking on that risk, and you have a good idea and you can't go to your friends and family networks anymore because those assets have dried up, where do you go? And what we used to be built upon with entrepreneurship in rural Minnesota was taking that risk, having somebody back you, at the return rates that he talked about, those are modest rates. When you're looking for capital, you know you're going to have to pay a coupon on that. You know you're going to have to pay for some of that risk. So I understand where your questions are, Representative Mahoney. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to solve a different problem.
Representative Mahoney.
You know, in this building, in our lives, we don't try to do a lot of things. But what you're doing here is dividing the state. You're pitting one organization, one part of the state against another. And, you know, that happens in a lot of states. We are the third best state in the nation in terms of business and business development. And certainly our urban areas carry more weight in that ranking than our smaller towns, and I get that. And again, Representative Albright's got a bill coming up very, very quickly that that puts $100 million in, makes a lot of money for the capital markets. Let's not kid ourselves. This is a $60 million tax break to wealthy people, wealthy investors. And that's to be decided in the tax committee. I don't need to go there. But one of my issues with this, and that map that's going around shows that there's poverty across this state. Our banks have got significant capital. They're afraid to lend for a variety of reasons. Depends on who's talking and what day. But again, I view this, no matter what you just said, as trying to set up us against them. And which all of us are really in the same boat trying to make Minnesota a better spot. I could come up with a whole bunch of programs, and I have in the past, that try to help greater Minnesota. They run into buzzsaws sometimes, but anyhow, I have a real problem with this bill because it sets up, it's an us against them. It's really not the way we should go as a state. I'm going to be supporting Albright's bill. I'll vote to send this to tax committee because I see the tax chair has got his name on this bill, so it's probably going to go there anyhow. But you should know that anybody reading this bill is going to look at it and go, oh, that's what they're doing. So.
There are other representatives, Heason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you explain why this is better than the I see on the sheet you refer to the New Market tax credit. So why is this a better approach than that?
Madam Chair, I'm going to let my testifier take that one, if that's okay.
I was aiming it there.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's different. I wouldn't say that it's a better or worse. It's just different. I think to the point about rural and looking at the difference of greater Minnesota to the urban areas and the metropolitan areas, so the last statistic I looked at using a source called PitchBook, which just is an aggregator of all investments, private investments that have been made in a state. This is outside of what the banks are doing. So outside of the urban areas in Minnesota, only 3.9% of that capital or the deals that have been done have gone to greater Minnesota. I know that more than 3.9% live there. It's, you know, roughly a fifth or so of the population is there. So I think that the big difference, and Representative Mahoney, to your point as well, if it's not targeted to rural, it just won't happen. I mean, I can speak just from a private investor's perspective that when we are given any option in the world to do, we're going to go to the places where there are the most opportunities, it's the easiest to get to, and it's the best opportunity for us to get the return that we want. As soon as that starts to shrink, it's harder to do that and it's more expensive. So I think this can be complementary to that, and it's easier to, instead of having a larger program that could go anywhere, to have it actually bifurcated or separated, because without it, it just won't go to rural. It's easier to find opportunities other places, and so that disparity between rural and urban with what the private market actually does will remain stagnant in about the same place that it is already.
Representative Eason.
Thank you, and I appreciate the rural focus. Is there a difference between this and that proposal, getting rid of the geographic differences and how these work?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, the difference, there are a couple differences. One is the fund manager has a different license. So in the New Markets Tax Credit Program, that license is under the U.S. Treasury. They're called community development entities, and they apply through that program to get certifications. This program uses licenses under the SBA and the USDA. The SBA's license is called the SBIC, which you may have heard before, a small business investment company. It's a program that's been around for a very long time. And then also the RBIC, or Rural Business Investment Company program under the USDA. So it's a different designation. Those firms that have those licenses invest in small businesses only. So it's a differentiation there. It's not better or worse. Again, it's just this program is focused on small business investing. So it's going to get federally licensed small business investors who have long track records of raising capital for investment. So that would be one of the major differences.
Representative Thiessen.
Okay, so the new markets can invest in any size business.
Yes, yeah, any size business, or also there's often real estate or development projects for downtown areas or others. So it's definitely different there.
And
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then you said, at one point I thought you said that the money was going to be raised in Minnesota. But
Mr. Dressler.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen. So the capital is all raised by private investors. So, this program is also unique where there is capital raised in addition to the tax credit part that's incentivized, right? So some investors are investing and earning a tax credit for doing that, but then half of the capital is coming from another investor. That capital can come from anywhere. It doesn't have to be located in the state. What matters is that it is raised, and then that $100 million is invested in 2 years in the qualifying areas.
Representative Thiessen.
Okay, so it's not necessarily raised in Minnesota. So who are the investors?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, primarily institutional investors, just meaning banks, insurance companies, or it could be pension funds. I mean, it really depends on the SBIC or RBIC's relationships and who they raise capital from.
Representative Thiessen.
Okay, I think that's enough.
Are there additional questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Christian, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm a strong supporter of rural Minnesota, and I don't believe that just because we have a bill that focuses on rural Minnesota that we're somehow creating two Minnesotas. There's all kinds of bills that come through this place that focus on different parts of the states for various reasons, and in this case, it's economic development. But I want to share with folks, and if the Chair would indulge me, I have the opportunity to represent four of the most awesome companies in Minnesota. Without them and the entrepreneurs who started those companies, some of them a couple of generations ago, and the one in Roseville Polaris Industries started in 1954. Imagine that. It was the year I was born. By three men who had an idea and a dream. And they took a small manufacturing company in Roseville and turned it into something unbelievable that is today producing machines and toys and all kinds of things that we use literally all over the world, and they have manufacturing facilities and transportation facilities literally across the world. Last fall I had the opportunity to attend the funeral of the final surviving member of the people that started Polaris, David Johnson. And his son Mitchell spoke at the community service, and he talked about Polaris and referenced the other big companies up there that we have, and how in today's world, it will not happen again in rural Minnesota where a company is going to move into a small town like Roseville with 26 or 2,700 people and all of a sudden just spring onto the map and all of a sudden start employing 2,000 people. The likelihood that any of our small manufacturing facilities up there who employ maybe upwards of maybe 300 people, that someday they will expand to 3,000 or 2,500 people, it's a pipe dream. It just cannot happen, he said. And it's for a variety of reasons. It's not because anybody doesn't like rural Minnesota. It just has to do with logistics and all those things. And so, Representative Kresha, thank you for standing up for rural Minnesota. I support you.
Other questions? Seeing none, Representative West renews his motion that House File 1235 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Great. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that was a fantastic job of getting me through committee.
Chair Garofalo moves House File 1202 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
Madam Chair, I know Representative Albright is here and waiting, so why don't we take his bill up first, and then we'll take my incredibly divisive and controversial proposal next. Sorry.
Chair Garofalo withdraws the motion.
Sorry, I have to grab your time.
Representative Albright. Representative Vogel moves that House File 1303 be recommended to pass and move to the Committee on Taxes. We refer to the Committee on Taxes.
Madam Chair, there is a DE amendment that I'd like to take up before we discuss the bill. And I'm happy to explain the bill while you put your affairs in order behind the chair.
Representative Vogel moves the DE1 amendment.
Thank you. And members, just some notes on the DE amendment. It just basically provides for some clarifying language, which includes some additional reporting mechanisms. It also lowers the per credit allocation limit in order to accommodate some additional projects. It also expands the project eligibility for certain regionally significant projects. And with that, I stand for questions.
To the motion to put the bill in the form the author prefers. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, House File 1303.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1303 would establish a state-run new markets tax credit program in Minnesota based largely off the successful federal new markets program. The program's purpose is to encourage investors to make investments in low-income and distressed communities that lack access to capital. Let me just give you some background on this program. The Federal New Markets Program was established in 2000 as part of the Community Renewal Tax Relief Act of 2000. The program continues today and is recognized as an effective mechanism to promote economic activity in economically distressed areas. Over the years, it has benefited the entire state of Minnesota tremendously. It has leveraged over a $1 billion in excess of private capital to save or expand over 160 businesses and nonprofits in Minnesota. The vast majority of these remain in operation today, demonstrating that credit is effective for creating long-term, sustainable economic growth. The new market tax credit is not just a handout. It is a tool to incentivize and leverage private capital to pull off projects that wouldn't otherwise happen. The credit can be used to help finance private businesses as well as nonprofits. The program takes a truly geographically balanced approach, as you've heard from my dear friend, Representative Mahoney, to economic development, serving all over the state. The program concentrates on economically underserved areas based on U.S. Census data. The map in your packets highlights these areas. Generally, about one quarter of a project's cost is financed through the use of the credit, demonstrating how it effectively leverages, additional private capital. So why is this needed? While the federal program remains successful, increasingly, Minnesota is losing out to other lower-income states due to a limited supply of federal credits. Minnesota has an opportunity to continue the success of the new market tax credit by implementing its own. So in conclusion, before I turn it over to my testifiers, few other credits have such a successful track record of promoting economic development while addressing economically distressed areas. With that, I will turn your attention to Ms. Julia Neilmark, who is with the Midwest Minnesota Community Development Corporation, to offer more in-depth commentary on the program and the details of the legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Julia Neilmark from Midwest Minnesota Community Development Corporation in Detroit Lakes, where I run our New Markets Tax Credit Financing Division. Of MMCDC's $544 million in federal allocation, almost 70% has been utilized in rural Minnesota. This bill calls for a state New Markets Tax Credit modeled after the federal program, mm-hmm. which would provide a tool to reduce borrowing costs for businesses in areas lacking access to affordable capital. The tax credit equity stays in Minnesota with the business. The bill calls for a $300 million allocation over 3 years, which translates to tax expenditures totaling $117 million over 9 years, or an annual average of about $13 million cost to the state. The government receives a return on these credits in the form of increased future tax revenue and decreased assistance costs. We had a similar program in last year's tax omnibus bill that, as I'm sure most of you know, failed for a single word to pass. With the New Markets Tax Credit Program, we are able to work with most types of businesses to help them grow and create jobs. This has been rated as one of the top 25 most effective federal programs. It is by far the best tool we have for business growth and job creation in the community development industry. New Markets Tax Credits is a public-private partnership. For each $1 of government subsidy, we bring in about $7 of private investment. There's a high demand for these credits, usually about 7 times at the federal level, similar here in Minnesota. By adding the state credit, we'll be able to focus on Minnesota, both in the metro area and greater Minnesota. It's split equally in the bill. And we are also not considered an underserved state in the federal program, so the provision of federal tax credits here has reduced. Minnesota has benefited from over $1 billion of federal new markets financing through 2014, which has helped create over 8,500 permanent jobs and more than 12,000 construction jobs. However, since we're not an underserved state, that is somewhat declining. By passing this state new markets bill, we'll be able to facilitate some 3,000 permanent jobs over the next 9 years.
Thank you, Ms. Nelmark. Representative Albright, do you have additional testifiers?
I do, Madam Chair.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Cast, the CFO for Team Industries. Team is a design engineering manufacturing company with 5 plants in Minnesota. We've been designing, machining, drivetrain components, and assembling transmissions, transaxles, and CVTs for 50 years in Minnesota. With our headquarters in Bagley, and we have other plants in Audubon, Detroit Lakes, Park Rapids, and Cambridge, Minnesota, along with two facilities outside of the state. We are proud to be celebrating our 50th year this June. About 35% of our company is owned by employees in an ESOP. As you can remember, 2008-09 was very difficult for manufacturing. Our customers in ag, heavy truck, hydraulics, and recreational vehicles were reducing orders significantly, often 50 to 80% with very little notice. Battling for survival, we reduced our workforce by about 500 people, and we closed the facility in Baxter. As credit tightened, our bank put significant pressure on us to find a new lender and a new structure for our line of credit. We worked with MMCDC for several months. During that time, they put together a new market tax credit loan with a USDA guarantee. We were able to find an asset-based lender for our working capital loans based on inventory and receivables. This package gave us time to restructure our company, reduce costs, eliminate unprofitable programs, and avoid further reductions in the workforce. Our employees worked with us, surrendering a week of vacation or taking pay cuts. Management took pay cuts and vacation reductions. We suspended the 401k. We returned to profitability in 2010. In 2011, we were able to transition to a standard line of credit and restore benefits to employees. We emerged from the downturn a stronger, smarter company. We focused on smart, profitable growth, and we returned to over 1,100 employees. The outcome could have been much worse for all of our stakeholders without the interest-only payments from the NMTC loan, a moderate interest rate, subordinated security arrangements, and a partial debt forgiveness that we received at the end of the term. New markets financing helped us save 850 jobs at a difficult time and add about 300 more over the past 7 years. Since that downturn, we reported record sales for 2 years, followed by a modest reduction in 2016. We're a stronger company now with a reduced break-even point, good margins, and a strong balance sheet to remain a substantial contributor to the Minnesota outstate economy for many years. Team strongly supports a new markets tax bill in Minnesota. The structure shares risk while providing good potential returns to the investors and making credit available to companies that need it. Loans under these programs will strengthen our state economy by growing and retaining jobs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cass. Representative Albright, do you have additional testifiers?
I do not.
Would anyone like to speak for public comment? Seeing none, are there member questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So who can qualify as a qualified community development entity?
Ms. Nelmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen. A community development entity can be a number of development entities who have experience working in the state of Minnesota and have a mission for community development work. That includes for-profit and nonprofit entities. There are several of us in the state and several from outstate. MMCDC, Community Reinvestment Fund in Minneapolis, the Sunrise Banks in St. Paul and Minneapolis, the St. Paul Port Authority, Bremer Bank are all current new markets entities at the federal level. And then there are a number of, I believe, 9 or 12 entities from outside of Minnesota who have used federal new markets in the state.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Would the initiative foundations qualify for that?
Ms. Nelmark.
Madam Chair and Representative, the initiative foundations might qualify. We've put in some criteria in this bill that would allow parties who haven't participated in the federal new markets program the ability to learn how to do it and then get into it. But they would need to at least learn what the program is so that they're able to effectively carry out the transactions.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And where are they raising the money from? Who are the investors?
Ms. Nelmark.
The investors can be anybody who has a tax credit appetite, be it banks, private individuals, corporations, insurance companies. The most common investors in the federal program are large banks. Then the tax credit investment comes in as cash up front. It's leveraged up with about 70% of debt coming from any number of sources. We often use the small local banks, regional banks, et cetera, throughout Minnesota. And sometimes there are nonprofit foundations who participate. So it is pretty flexible and it allows quite a few parties to participate.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that. And you know, one of the reasons I'm asking some of these questions is, you know, there's two things that are going on, it seems to me. One is this issue of there's a lack of capital in rural Minnesota and parts of Tim and my communities as well. So that's one of the issues, and I get that this is trying to solve the problem of getting that capital there, which is, I think, a good thing. But the other problem is that there's a lack of capital in these communities, and one of the things we're doing is we're investing money in these businesses, but then the returns from that money, which is the thing that could actually build wealth in these communities, is going back out, and it's not staying in the communities necessarily. And so one thing I think we should try to think about, and maybe this is not entirely true, but one thing I think we should think about is, you know, is there a way that we could actually put together a program that would allow local communities to raise the money from their community so that when they invest in their local businesses, the wealth stays in that community? So anyway, that's more of a commentary than a question, but it looks like there actually is a response, too. So maybe I have a little bit of this wrong.
Ms. Nelmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, with the Federal New Markets Tax Credit Program, the returns to the investors, they don't get a return of their initial principal. They just get their return of capital and return on capital, their interest earnings, if you will, through the tax credit spread over 7 years. So the if they would put in, say, $3 million up front, they would get the 39% tax credit spread over 7 years, which time value discounted the dollars makes that roughly equivalent. So their earnings are, with today's pricing, around 4 to 5% on an after-tax basis. If you gross that up for pre-tax comparable rates, it's still in the, say, 8 to 10% comparable rate of return, which is a pretty standard or typical rate of return, if not low. The equity that comes in from the tax credit investor is lent to the business, and then if all goes as planned at the end of the 7 years, they get to keep the majority of that as that partial debt forgiveness that Steve Cast had referenced. Currently, that is about 25% of the initial loan. So if a business borrows New Markets tax credit loans of, say, $10 million, they get debt forgiveness net of costs of perhaps $2.5 million with today's pricing. So the money is truly staying in the communities here.
Well, but Madam Chair, the returns on the investment are not necessarily. I get that the money that's going into the business is staying in the community, but the investors that are taking the money out, the 8 to 10%, are not necessarily people that live in the community. So I get that the business is growing. That piece, I mean, that's how you do it regardless. But there is money flowing out of these communities. Part of this because the investors, you know, there's not as much money there. But we should try to figure out a way to actually be able to use local money to support these local businesses so that the returns that you're talking about, that 8 to 10%, you know, stay in Roseau and don't go to Chicago.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I certainly share your desire to keep the returns or the seed capital within the confines of the community that they're standing up a business in. But let's maybe just for the sake of reality, although I certainly would agree with you that if there's an opportunity to keep the capital in the community, we certainly would want to that. But let's be realistic about it, that we're looking for capital from all ventures that will stand up businesses that can then support families in the community that will eventually then stand up other businesses and be beneficial to the retail establishments, be beneficial to the volunteer fire department, be beneficial to the school in that area. And so while I agree, I think that we might be chasing after something that's illusory, whereas the emphasis that's in this bill is to stand up a business in a community that can support itself and support the families in that community and really come around the community that's distressed or where there isn't a desire for capital other than from potentially places outside of the community itself. So,
Representative Thiessen.
No, I don't disagree. I'm a co-author on the bill, so I'm not disagreeing with that. I just think it's something that we should challenge ourselves to think about because I think there's something there that we're missing a little bit.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question maybe for each of the individuals there. So we established that the businesses can do better. And the gentleman from team, I'm sorry, I didn't know your name.
Steve Cast.
Mr. Cast.
What was your name?
Cast.
Okay. I just want to ask you and also the author and the other witness. So one of the things that I don't see here is the actual goals, I guess I'd say, for the wages of the jobs. So I see that the business came back in team, for example, and I think you described the scenario where the workers there gave up some of their wages, and they gave up their 501 when their 401k. And so when you returned to a prosperous situation, did the wages go back or up higher? And I guess that's a question I have in general for each of you. Do we have anything in the legislation that says, yes, the business will do better, you know, and come back, the investors, the tax credit investors will do well. But what about the actual goals for wages and numbers of jobs? I see, looking at the document here, there's a number of jobs that are created, and I see that there's a number of jobs that are retained, and that's all great. But what I'm wanting to know is, are those jobs at a same or a higher level? Do the workers benefit as well as the business and the investors, or is there a difference there? Because we do have that kind of requirement for other kinds of public expenditures to create jobs, and I'm just wondering what you can tell us about that.
Ms. Nelmar. Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill does provide for a requirement as well as reporting on an annual basis from the community development entities and the businesses that the wages would be at least 105% of the poverty guidelines. And typically they're much higher than that. The jobs created also include a number of construction jobs, typically quite a bit more. To date, we've had over 12,000 construction jobs in Minnesota created through the federal program, through 2014. And those are typically much higher paying, including direct wages as well as benefits. We try on each of these deals to ensure that the businesses will provide living wages or higher to the employees as well as benefits. And I think Mr. Cast could speak to that at Team Industries, that the employees were brought back up to their higher wages, and Team is one of the higher paying employers in those rural communities that they're working in.
Thank you. Cast.
Madam Chair, Representative, our company reacts to external, internal factors on wages and compensation, you know, every week. And we've discussed, I've heard a testimony earlier today about limited jobs in rural areas. That's a fact. We've had to raise starting wages. As we become profitable, we share the success of the company with employees in a generous bonus program. We've chosen an ESOP structure to provide a benefit to employees in their long-term retirement plans. All those things mixed together to provide a good, wholesome, successful wage and benefit package for people in our communities.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm looking to the language to see where it might be that situation is. Living wages, I think I heard said a number of times, and that's really the goal, I would hope. But I notice on page 4, lines 430 to 432, we're talking about poverty guidelines. And so I'm wondering, is there a place in here where we could talk more about living wages as something that's being sought? And if not, why not? And Madam Chair?
Ms. Nelmark. Thank you, Madam Chair. The requirement in here is for a family of four, so it is perhaps a little higher than what you would expect. And the minimum was set to allow for those businesses who are starting employees at a certain level of wage and then working them up towards a higher wage. And however, we need to allow for the businesses to be sustainable and to set the wages that make sense in their communities and will keep them in business. Typically, if an employer is hiring new employees and promoting current employees up to higher levels, they often are training in people to stay in for the long time, and they will work up to the higher levels of wages. That is what we see most often.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. I guess what I'm looking for is some sort of way to say that in the legislation that really creates those goals. It's not unusual for our state to have economic development, job-creating programs that have these kinds of goals spelled out as a part of our law. when we deal with deed and grants and subsidies and so on. And I'm just noticing, so we got, you know, for example, a hotel project. I'm just seeing what those hotel workers make. The bakery project, you know, what do those bakery folks make? Laundry project. Those may all be very good projects, but I'm just wondering if we have somewhere in here a look at, you know, an actual standard or goal that would lead us to make sure that those jobs eventually are good paying. Because usually in these areas, the wages are probably fairly low.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
And Representative Clark will certainly take it under advisement as this legislation moves through the committee process.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you've had experience with the new market credit, tax credits in the past. Either one of the testifier here. Do you have an idea of what the divide is between Greater Minnesota and Urban Minnesota? Is it a 50-50 split? Is it a 60-40 split? I know new markets have been used in my particular district on a couple of projects. They didn't quite pay a living wage, but they helped a lot of teenagers. So, but what's that split? Do you know?
Ms. Nomar. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know exactly the split, but I can say that MMCDC has provided or worked on the projects for probably two-thirds of the new markets allocation used in the state, and 70% of ours has been in Greater Minnesota. So I would say it's not representative of the whole country, but I would say in Minnesota we have better than 50% of the federal new markets allocation has been used in Greater Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney.
I think one of the legislators that should have heard that just left a while ago. But where would I find that number? Who would be able to give me the number of 50-50s, 60-40, 70s, and 30?
Deed would probably have that.
Do I need to go to our tax people?
We can talk with Deed, or I can work with the other new markets allocatees in the state and try to determine that. We get a list from the agency in Washington that helps us accumulate information. I can find that and get it to you. I will say that the other allocatees in Minnesota are all in the Twin Cities, so they have quite a few projects down here. I just haven't accumulated those totals myself lately.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions?
I'm sorry,
Representative Mahoney.
It's actually not a question. It's kind of a past experience. I've put together package after package for Greater Minnesota, and they come back and it's consistently said that money goes where the opportunity is, money goes here, money goes there. And really what I have found is most of the investors just have short legs and they can't get to the acceleration pedal and get beyond the 694, 494 circle. And I get the frustration that many people have. And it is a great frustration for me because I've always believed that the state is one big entity. Representative Albright, you're a reasonably smart man. You could probably come up with a couple and be just as disappointed as me with those incentives to get people out to Greater Minnesota, job creators out there. One of the things with this particular tax credit, here's my one question, and then there'll probably be one other, and I'll be done, is what's the actual tax loss to the state of Minnesota to do $300 million in new market credits?
Ms. Nomar.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney. The tax loss for this bill is $117 million, which would be awarded spread over 3 years. So it would be an average of $13 million per year over the 9 years that it's utilized. So it would range from $5 to $18 million per year of foregone taxes.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, you know, we could, you know, $18 million and a couple million dollars that the chair continues to put in a MIF and job creation, you could get to $20 million a year, and, you know, then that money would actually stay in the community or in the state of Minnesota. But I'm a co-author on the bill also, so I won't say anything more than that, and I'll let it go.
Are there additional questions? Ms. Nelmark?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more comment. The largest investor with us for New Markets Tax Credits in Minnesota has been U.S. Bank, who, as I'm sure many of you know, is based in Minnesota. And we work on a regular basis with others to increase their appetite for new markets. As an example, Bremer Bank has worked with MMCDC providing some of the loans in our new markets deals and has recently become an investor in a couple of deals, and now this year has received a new markets allocation of their own. So we definitely are trying to keep the new markets benefits at all levels in the state and having some success with that.
Thank you. Thank Representative Albright, do you have any final words?
Brevity is my friend, Madam Chair, and so I'll stop at that.
Excellent. Rep. Vogel renews his motion that House File 1303, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Chair Garofalo moves House File 1202 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is my bill. As far as I know, it's opposed by no one. It costs nothing, and I would ask for members' support.
All right. I have a serious question.
We roll call this one.
All right. Chair Garofalo, do you have any testifiers?
No.
Would anyone like to make public comment? Are there member questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
Is this Representative Chair Garofalo's first bill from this committee?
He should be like an Iron Ranger in place.
Chair Garofalo?
No, it's not my first time before the committee, Madam Chair.
Representative Neuberger. Any other member questions?
Madam Chair, just a comment.
You have not changed at all, have you?
I kept quiet during the first mention of the Iron Range, and I figured I would just say that if a ranger pays twice, he eats twice. Or she.
There you go.
Representative or Chair Garofalo, do you have any final words?
No.
All right, then Chair Garofalo renews his motion to move House File 1202 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. Chair Garofalo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just for scheduling purposes for members, I know we have a robust legislative agenda tomorrow, but just for next week with committee deadlines, members should plan on extra committee hearings, probably a couple of late nights with the early deadlines, just for scheduling purposes. So there's going to be board meeting quite a bit next week. Just plan accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you. We are adjourned.